The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by the University System of New Hampshire in partnership with its four institutions around the state. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn what you can accomplish here.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, in for Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. This week, the state budget was on the main menu for New Hampshire lawmakers with a large side order of politics. Along with the usual spending and revenue items, lawmakers included longtime conservative priorities in the budget, such as abortion restrictions and school vouchers. We'll cover this on the roundup today, but first, lawmakers and the governor this week dedicated more money to mental health care after the state lost a recent lawsuit over inadequacies in our mental health system. Also, debate continued across the state over coming reductions in unemployment insurance related to the pandemic. Listeners, what questions or personal experiences do you have with these issues? Give us a call now at 800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. With me are Allie Pham, NHPR's health and equity reporter. Welcome back, Allie. It's great to have you.
Great to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Anne-Marie Timmons, senior reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin. And Anne-Marie, welcome back to The Exchange. Nice to have you on the air again.
Thank you. Great to be here with you and Allie.
So let's start with unemployment. Big news. By mid-June, 35,000 Granite Staters will lose $300 worth of enhanced unemployment benefits. Another 10,000 people will lose benefits that have been available for self-employed workers and gig workers and so forth. Governors in about half the states are doing this, saying these benefits were related to the pandemic. And now as the pandemic eases, the economy opens up, these are just not needed anymore. That's the argument there. Allie and Anne-Marie, you've both been talking with people who are affected by this. So Allie, what group have you been focused on and what are they telling you?
Yeah, so this week I've been chatting with women who are in a childcare squeeze, so to speak, where they often lost jobs or left the workforce to take care of their kids. And the jobs that they left or lost often were salaried or maybe had flexible hours. And now when they're looking at a lot of the jobs that are open, what they're finding is that they don't pay enough for these women to afford childcare or might not offer them flexible hours. So, you know, if you're making $10 or even $15 or $20 an hour, that might be less or the same as childcare costs. So in just a plain economic sense, working is kind of negating itself. And I spoke to Sherry Pratt of Belmont, and before the pandemic, she was working in business development, and she's been actively applying for jobs and also searching for childcare for her daughter. And so far, neither have panned out, and the childcare has been a real sticking point. So here's what she told me on that.
I have to be available at 2 o'clock for the rest of the day for my daughter. I am approved for funds through our local agency at 10 hours a week, maximum $15 an hour. My daughter's 18. She's very strong. She can get aggressive. She needs help with toileting. Is $15 an hour enough for somebody to deal with that who doesn't love her? I can't find anybody.
Wow. So, Allie, you know, these women that you've been talking to, they're saying it's not one for one. You know, the job I lost paid enough to afford childcare, was flexible enough so I could jump in. Mm-hmm. The jobs that are out there now don't fit that definition.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that really stuck with me about my conversation with Sherry Pratt, who we just heard, and some of the other women, is also the ways that they felt isolated and ashamed about being unemployed, you know, and all of these women recognize that there are lots of jobs out there, but that, you know, for them, these jobs might just work. But that narrative is so powerful that there are thousands of jobs out there and unemployed people are sitting at home collecting money. And they say, you know, that's not what we're doing. But they've kind of internalized that. And you know, I mean, Sherry had told me, I feel really ashamed to tell people that I'm unemployed.
Interesting. And Emery, I definitely want to ask you about this too, but we have a couple callers who want to join us as well. So let's go to Cameron first in Bedford. Welcome, Cameron. You're on the weekly news roundup on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a business owner, small business owner. I own a few franchises, UPS stores, basically. And we, among the whole network, all of us are suffering wicked badly with the health shortage. We get the ad going on there. Nobody applies. And even the employees we have like getting sometimes stolen by the other businesses. So I don't know what the government is doing to get the workforce back. I heard they suspended the unemployment, but still we're not really seeing anything getting better.
Wow, Cameron, I'm so glad you called. If I could ask a question or two, because it's good to get the business perspective in here. So what kind of franchise do you run?
It's a UPS store.
A UPS store. Okay. And you're having a really hard time finding employees.
Yeah.
And do you think that the removal of these extra pandemic-related unemployment benefits will bring more people into the workforce, Cameron, or not?
I mean, that's what I'm assuming, though, because obviously every business is looking for help. Like, I'm a member of, like, some of these D&I groups. All the business owners are struggling right now finding good help. Most of them are, like, working themselves. Are, you know, trying to see if they can increase the pay, but obviously the businesses really got to support the extra pays as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just, so it's, I don't know, it's maybe a bigger catastrophe coming our way.
So we've heard a lot, Cameron, from women who, you know, for childcare reasons, can't jump back into the workforce full time, or they need more flexibility, or they need higher pay to cover those childcare costs. What's the conversation at your business and among, you know, your fellow business owners about, you know, changes that you can make to encourage more parents to rejoin the workforce?
Again, it really depends. I'm in more in the retail industry, so we are just all game. It's very hard for us, because obviously the customers are really wanting the shop to be open at certain time and closed. And if you close early, then they leave negative feedbacks on Google and all these. And then also, since Amazon came into the world, this whole 7 days a week kind of thing have made things even more difficult for business owners too. And like people expecting more, but they don't really want to pay more. You know what I mean?
Interesting. All right. Well, Cameron, it's great to hear from you. Thank you for adding your story to our program today. And boy, Emery, I've heard talking to restaurants a couple weeks ago, they are having to, you know, close early or not offer certain services. I tried to go out to eat to a certain restaurant last night outside. They said, sorry, no outside dining tonight because we don't have the staff. So there you go. You've been talking with people, Emery, about this as well. What have you learned from some of these workers?
I think what we just heard from Cameron and Sherry really sums up what I've been hearing. People are stuck on both ends. I think it's important to note that what I've been hearing, I think Allie too, is this women. We've heard a lot from women, and we know that the pandemic has had an uneven impact on men and women. And I think this is another example of that. I talked to a woman yesterday whose daughter is a special ed student, lost a lot of ground over the year with hybrid learning that did not work for her. So she feels like her choices to let her daughter languish in education for the summer and then go back to school next year way behind and get a job, or stay home and try to catch up her daughter. That's just a no-win situation. And I think as Cameron was saying, he has a job, yes, hours are not flexible. So it feels like a mismatch to me between the people who still need help and the kinds of jobs that are available. And I did a story on this recently and looked at a couple analysis of what are the most common jobs being posted right now. It's DoorDash, it's Uber, it's Burger King, it's Domino's. Those are not jobs that work for families who need some flexibility. So I think that is a really hard piece. One woman I spoke to, there's a Facebook group actually with 4,600 members that's just for unemployment during COVID challenges. And they feel like maybe this unemployment should have been stepped down rather than just ended right away. I think it's there's been a lot of focus on this $300 additional payment because that's just very easy to talk about. And the rest of the federal aid is complicated, so it's harder to explain. But that's 15,000 people plus who are going to have no unemployment come mid-June because all federal unemployment ends. And that's, as you were saying, you know, self-employed, gig workers, people who have been home because of a COVID-related reason, all that ends on June 19th. So it leaves a big gap, and the solution is very hard. Like, I don't think ending unemployment is going to solve that problem that we just heard from Cameron and Sherry.
Well, again, Cameron, thank you for the call. And listeners, we're taking more of your calls right now as we talk about this shifting, changing unemployment insurance situation. We welcome your comments, experiences at 800-892-6477 or by email exchange at nhpr.org. And Allie and Anne-Marie, Michael is calling in from Somersworth. Hi, Michael. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm a single father. I have two young kids. One is special needs. She has a para with her all day long at school now that they've been back for a month. Last year when school shut down, I struggled. I was taking my kids to work to try and, keep things smooth. When they weren't going back to school, I was forced to leave my job. I just, the stress and everything associated with that, I just couldn't deal with. So I left a very high-paying job, significantly more than I make on unemployment, even with the federal money. And now I have to face, in a few weeks that I'm going to lose that. I'm going to go back to making, I think it's $12,000 a year. I'm in a situation where my kids, I don't have a summer camp I can put them in. I think there's a lot of people like me who would love to go back. There's plenty of jobs in my field where I could actually go back to work. The problem is finding childcare, finding babysitters, and I just feel like the governor is really doing us a disservice by assuming that we're just sitting at home collecting money and not wanting to work.
Michael, I'm so sorry to hear what happened to you last year. That sounds really tough. So what do you think you're going to do? Are you going to try and get back into your old field, or are you going to, just take one of these lower paying jobs that our guest described? What's your thinking there?
My particular situation, I don't have much of a choice. I'm just going to have to struggle until they get back into school. This point, there's nothing else I can do. With schools going back, opening, I'm hoping that the before and after care programs will be back open as well, which is obviously, a big help for people like me who are single and, work regular jobs. So, unfortunately, I'm going to have to go a few months of struggling and going back to not paying my bills and getting behind on my mortgage and everything else. So,
Michael, have you reached out to your local CAP agency? I'm just curious about that because they sometimes have ideas.
Gotten some assistance, which has been phenomenal. But again, it's still, with the extra federal money, I'm at a position where I can make my bills, and the kids and I can get out and do some things. But, the reality is I'm still not making what I was making before. And, we're still on the verge of, collapse, really.
Yeah. And as a single dad, you can't just go wait tables at a restaurant because somebody's got to stay with the kids. I've got my fingers crossed for you, Michael, and I want to let you know on Wednesday we're going to be talking to the Deputy Commissioner of Employment Security more about these situations. So for now, thank you for calling, but stay tuned for that, okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay. Wow. Amazing stories. Allie, single parents, just trying to pull it together, but you can't leave the house for, 8 hours without childcare. But if you don't make enough money to pay for childcare, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the points that Michael made too is the difficulty of summer coming up, where he's not alone in not being able to find a summer camp option for his kids. And I think that's one of the really tricky parts about pulling this federal aid now is initially it had been, you know, going through September. So it would have gotten parents through that summer period. And now that's not going to happen. So it's, you know, putting folks like Michael in a really tough situation there.
So Jim and Bo writes, why is the governor so intent on rejecting federal money that would be spent in New Hampshire and benefit the overall New Hampshire economy? Just not smart, Jim says. I'm glad he wrote, because I myself have been a little confused about which of this money is federal, which of it is state. As I said earlier, 21 governors are sort of doing what our governor does, but that means about, you know, 20 some odd governors are not. Can either of you sort of clarify the federal versus state nature of this?
I can take a stab at it.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
Anne-Marie, you go. I can add if needed.
it's confusing. I think one reason is because this money keeps coming in. It's unprecedented amount of money. It's hard to even process what $1 billion is to the state. And while it says, you know, this money is in for infrastructure, like the newest money that's coming in, about $1 billion just for the state. Yes, it's for infrastructure, but there's an ability to float things that was going to be paid for by tax dollars into the federal lane for money and then free up some money for other projects. It feels very fungible to me. It's unclear to me how the state's going to decide to spend that money. I think a lot of people are wondering that. And so I hear this again and again, where is this federal money? Why isn't this helping me? It's available to so many other things, like state libraries can get some federal aid, pandemic relief aid. So people, I think, are legitimately asking why. Why can't this be available to people on unemployment? And I think Memorial Day is a good marker to have this conversation, because I think people are pivoting to masks are coming off. We have 60% of the state vaccinated. People are returning to normal. But Ali, myself, people work in legal assistance or community action programs, hear the stories where the new normal is not even close to the old normal. So there's a lot of people being left behind. And I do think that's the question. And I don't think we know an answer to it.
Well, listeners, again, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear your thoughts as we turn now to the state's mental health system. What questions or experiences do you have with that system? Give us a call at 800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. So, Anne-Marie, you have been looking at the mental health budget this year, and you've been looking at the mental health system for a long time. Just remind us, Anne-Marie, about that court decision that came down recently. I know we talked about it on the roundup, that ruled that extended emergency room stays are a violation of patient rights. The judge agreed. And so now the governor and lawmakers have had to kind of scramble to figure this out.
Yes. The 2 days after that decision came down, the governor said, you know, the court decision said we must make a change, so we will. And it almost instantly, you saw the numbers of adults waiting in emergency rooms go from high 30s. Yesterday, there were 3. So there's been very quick action on that to get them into, you know, out of the state, out of the emergency rooms and into some kind of care. Children remain high. It was over 30 yesterday, and that hasn't really changed. It's gone up, in fact. So I think what's important here is that people, mental health advocates have been saying we must for 10, 15, 20 years. So as we see with a lot of things, it takes a lawsuit often to really make the state move. So now there suddenly is money to do all the things that have been in the 10-year plan that's coming forward. The pandemic, which ironically caused so much of an increase in mental health needs, is also now where that money is coming from to help get these initiatives moving. So for example, the governor and the state have said, we're going to provide hospitals $200,000 a year per bed for every designated receiving facility bed, they're called, who will take someone out of state hospital into care. Previously, state was offering half that. And when it was half that, it was going to cost the hospitals money to offer these beds. It just was impossible. And the governor has complained that no one has been putting bids in for this work all along, but that's the reason. It was not enough money. It wasn't a lack of care and desire and a belief it needed to be done. It just wasn't enough money. You know, the community mental health centers could not put a bid in for transitional housing because, again, it would cost them money that they don't have. That money, there's more money for that now. And so that is moving forward. So it looks like we're going in the right direction. Again, I think there's some head scratching and some, you know, regret that it took this court decision to do that. But, you know, I think what you'll hear them say is at least we're moving forward now.
Well, we've seen that with other issues here in New Hampshire, haven't we? Sort of decision making by lawsuit. And it happens. It happens in other states as well, not just New Hampshire. So it seems like, Gabri, from what you're saying, they've moved pretty quickly since this court decision.
They have. This isn't something that's, I will say, in my opinion, been transparent. So it's been hard to figure out what is going on. I don't know if that's a result of it moving so quickly. But I think I've even in talking to some of the advocates in the state, they also are a little unsure, you know, what is next. So I don't think there's a clear answer. Like, what is next? When is the mobile crisis response unit going to come on? You know, the legislature in 2019 called for that, put the money up, and here we still are, and it's not open. And part of that was because the state said, let's expand it beyond kids, because there's adults who need this care too. Sure. Pandemic certainly showed it down, but you know, that was going to, you know, they think possibly resolve 80% of the cases that are now going to the ER because there's no other help. So things remain stalled, and it's unclear to me exactly when we're going to make the next step and what that step will be.
Well, Ali Pham, last question for you, please. What are you going to be covering next week, or at least keeping an eye on? You've got, as our health reporter, you know, you've got a lot on your plate.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll definitely continue to follow the unfolding unemployment story. But then another thing I'm going to be looking into next week, which kind of came out of a conversation I had yesterday, is just this kind of change in mindset and strategy in vaccine distribution. I was talking with the emergency preparedness coordinator at a hospital in North Conway, and he said, you know, for so long, the mindset has been, don't waste a single shot. And he says now the mindset is starting to shift to don't waste a single arm. And the hospital is trying to figure out, change up their hours, change up their strategy for getting vaccines out. So I think that kind of new mindset and change in strategy is something I'll continue to follow up on.
All right. We'll keep an ear out for that. Ali, thank you very much. You're always helping us out on the roundup. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Ali Pham, NHPR's health and equity reporter. Here's another story that NHPR is covering. Employees at a Salem record store say they were fired after raising concerns about the end of the store's mask mandate and a lax response to customers who harassed workers. They're now calling for a boycott of the Maine-based Bull Moose chain, which sells music, books, movies, games, art. Several former workers at the company's Salem location told NHPR there were things they loved at their jobs, but employees also say they frequently experienced upsetting and even unsafe interactions with customers with little or no response from management, from sexual and racial harassment to dealing with threats from irate customers over mask requirements. You can read more on this story and others at our website, nhpr.org. Well, coming up, Anne Marie Timmons will be staying with us, and NHPR's Josh Rogers comes on board to dive into the politics of this state budget. First, though, a quick break. And listeners, during the break, let's get your questions in too. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or call us 800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Canoy, in for Peter Biello. As we cover some of the top news of the week, let's turn now to the state budget. Every 2 years, the governor and lawmakers have to craft a spending plan by the end of June. And so by late May, the tension is often rising. This year is no exception, with longtime conservative priorities included in the budget. Listeners, what are your thoughts about the budget process this year? What questions do you have? Give us a call at 800 800- 892-6477. 6477, or you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Anne-Marie Timmons with the New Hampshire Bulletin is still with us, and joining us now is NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers. Josh, nice to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning to you both.
So, Josh, just give us a budget 101 here, please. How does this process, how is it supposed to play out? How does it usually play out?
Well, the way it works is the governor proposes a spending plan that then gets passed to the House, which typically jettisons a lot of what governors propose, and that's irrespective of the partisan makeup of the House or the occupant of the corner office. The House Finance Committee works on a plan, passes it on to the full House votes, heads to the Senate. The Senate typically, by virtue of its place in the calendar, has access to more predictive revenue numbers. So it's typical for the House to pump up the spending a little bit, again, irrespective of the makeup of the state house. And, the House Finance Committee goes through its budget process, often jettisoning plenty of the work done by the House and the governor. Generally, it becomes kind of a hodgepodge, but the Senate tends to have a stronger hand in the budget process. And then, the Senate passes its budget, and then House and Senate negotiators typically get together and haggle over differences. And there's sort of interchamber tensions over policy priorities and sometimes over the bottom line. And then, presuming they get to agreement, it heads to the governor's desk, and the governor can either sign it, let it become law without his or her signature, or veto it. And, budget vetoes have been, more common in the past decade than they certainly have been previously. And something needs to be in place by June 30th, or we head into continuing resolution or sort of temporary budget territory.
Right. And so we're in that territory now, heading towards June 30th. So how is this time different, Josh? If at all, maybe it's not that different.
Well, one way it's different is just the amount of money that is available to lawmakers. I mean, if you look at just the revenue estimates that the Senate is working with compared to what the House worked with, you're talking about, north of $300 million more money the Senate believes it can spend than the House.
Wow,
and then on top of that, there's the $1 billion out of the rescue plan that's coming to the state, $500 million that's arrived, and $500 million more that's going to come next year that is going to be taken up largely outside of the budget process. But there's a lot of money, and traditionally, particularly when Republicans are in charge, the budget dynamic is how do we pass a plan that we can say meets the needs of the people in the state while also not raising taxes. And this year we're in a position where there are tax cuts to several major taxes, business taxes, a phase out of the interest and dividends tax, a little bit off the rooms and meals tax, and so you've got more money coming in certainly than I or anybody else can recall, and more tax cutting going on too, at least the state taxes. I mean, people can fight about the implications of the local property tax, and also this year non-budgetary, non-spending items are certainly very prominent in the debate over the budget.
So let's talk about that just a little bit more, Josh, because my recollection is, and I've covered the legislature for a long time, is that in the first year of the session, that's the budget year. So you fight over the budget. In the second year of the session, that's when you fight over, guns, abortion, sort of these non... Or reach agreement, which they eventually do. They eventually do. So my sense in the past has been first year, fiscal stuff, budget, second year, all the sort of, hot button political issues. What's happening with that this year?
Well, I mean, certainly, there is some of that that goes on as people get closer to election, wanting to put either, I mean, it's easier to pass a controversial priority probably in year one than year two of a biennium, but it is interesting this year that, even though we have reasonably narrow Republican majorities, 4 seats in the Senate, 25 seats in the House, there have been policies that are by New Hampshire standards, quite conservative ones, sort of whipping through the legislature, on gun rights issues, on, abortion and a ban on abortion after 24 weeks, which is something that New Hampshire has rarely contemplated seriously. And New Hampshire is one of the few states without a gestational limit on abortion. That's in the state budget. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to that. There are other issues around the pandemic, around the makeup of the New Hampshire House is the margin is the partisan edge is narrow for Republicans, but there's it's more conservative than it has been in some time, and it is interesting that they are managing to get things through the legislature. I do think distance lawmaking is probably helpful in that regard. That things that larger GOP majorities have struggled to pass, and we'll see where some of these end up. I mean, Governor Sununu, he bills himself as supportive of abortion rights. It looks like a restriction on abortion is going to be hitting his desk. It's an interesting moment for the Republican Party and for what is being contemplated in a spending plan.
Well, sure. And we've seen debates over abortion many times in the legislature, but it seems more rare to include it in the state budget. And Anne-Marie, I want to turn to you. So what was that original abortion proposal in the budget? What was significant about that?
Not only this abortion ban at 24 weeks, it was also something we've seen come up before, which is the abortion providers, we have three main ones in the state, would have to physically and financially separate the abortion services from all the routine care they do, like cancer screenings, STD testing, birth control. And they said we already financially separate. We do not use public money for abortions, but to put a different staff and to find different space to do what is essentially 7% of their work just would not be financially sustainable and would jeopardize, care to 15,000 people by their estimate. And so currently in the budget, and the House said that's non-negotiable. Both of those things are non-negotiable. If they come out of the budget, you probably won't get pass it in the House. So what the Senate has done is put the 24-week ban, into the budget. They removed that separation requirement. And I think it'll be interesting to see where that goes, because this contract for Planned Parenthood, which is the prime provider of these services, goes before the executive council sometime probably this summer, possibly early fall. And the council in the past has voted that contract down on those same grounds. If you can't separate financially and physically, we're not going to approve this contract, and they have to. And it's the primary source of their funding. Governor Sununu voted the contract down on those grounds when he was on the council. And three of the sitting councilors have also previously voted it down on those grounds. So I think that fight is not over. It's not in the state budget right now, but it's not over.
I see. So there's two issues. One is this 24 weeks ban that Josh talked about. The other is concerning renewal of a contract for Planned Parenthood. Is that right, Anne-Marie?
Yes, correct.
I see. So do we know, Josh alluded to this, Anne-Marie, do we know how the governor feels about this 24 weeks abortion ban?
He has not said. He's been asked, but has not said. The comment from his spokesperson was, the budget is an ever-changing document. It's a process. I'll see what lands on my desk and I'll decide then.
Well, and Josh, among State House reporters, how much speculation was there yesterday that this is why the governor didn't have his weekly press conference? That he didn't want to address this abortion issue. He didn't want to be asked about it.
Well, the governor was also out of state this week at a Republican Governors Association meeting, and so he was traveling. And typically when governors of either party attend those partisan political things, they often tack a day of fundraising on, and the governor's gearing up to make a decision about his political future. So that may have been as much the reason why he was not around for a briefing yesterday as anything else.
Well, and I want to ask you about a couple other items that were put in the budget, and one concerns a bill that we have heard so much about from our listeners called the so-called divisive concepts bill. Josh,
well, the Senate has its own version of that provision, which they unveiled this week. This hasn't been subject to a public hearing. So we haven't had a much public discussion of it, but it was billed by Senate leaders as having been the product of weeks of work, including some work apparently by Attorney General John Formella, what the Senate is calling it as a right to freedom from discrimination in public workplaces and education. And it's about 3 pages long. And among other things, some notable bits of this bill would allow public employees to opt out of any training that suggests race, sex, or other immutable characteristics could make somebody inherently oppressive or oppressed, even unconsciously. So what that means for implicit bias training is a little murky. This bill would also lay the ground for lawsuits against school districts that don't comply. So how much of a lever this would give people concerned about curricular choices in schools? It's more direct about it than the House language, and troubling to some school board types, I'm assuming. But this bill was just aired, a day and a half ago, and right, it's in the budget, and there's going to be more discussion about it. But Republicans, their point on this is that this will, in their estimation, assure equality under the law. Democrats say this is going to limit necessary teaching on systemic racism and bias. So, the bottom line isn't new in terms of the politics around this.
Well, let's go to another call. And again, our number here on the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 800-892-6477. We're combing through the state budget right now with Josh Rogers and Anne-Marie Timmons and looking at some of the other non-budgetary items that have been placed in the budget, like limits on abortion, like this so-called divisive concepts bill. Anne-Marie and Josh, Dana's calling from Laconia. Hi, Dana. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good morning.
Sure.
So my call and my comment this morning was directly about the divisive concept amendment. So the former House Bill 544, which got put into the budget. And I mainly want people to be aware of the really dangerous language in the budget right now and holding our senators responsible, our governor, who has said that he will not sign a budget with the language that was in it. But like Josh said, alternative verbiage was introduced just a day or two ago. The fact is this language still, in my opinion, would not hold up under the Constitution. This is a hugely problematic language that is incredibly dangerous for New Hampshire, that is going to limit all kinds of things. And so really, I just wanted people to be aware of that and take action. There's petitions going around. There are days of action coming up, depending what comes out of these, budget hearings. So I would just encourage everybody to stay involved, make your voice loud and heard, and let them know that this is not acceptable in our state.
Well, Dana, thank you for calling. And here's an email from Jesse in Littleton who says, I think this bizarre budget is a great example of a larger issue. We should reconsider actually paying state legislators. Nearly unpaid legislators is one of those concepts that sounds good on paper, Jesse says, but the reality of what that actually does is less pretty. No one can afford to serve in the state legislature unless they're already independently wealthy, which leaves a huge swath of the state completely unrepresented. And we get the budgets and legislation this Congress, I think he means legislature, has regurgitated into the world. Jesse, thank you for writing. And boy, Emery, that's a long-going debate over state lawmakers and whether you get what you pay for or not.
It sure is. As long as I've been covering the state, 25 plus years, that has been a conversation. I think it's a, there's good and bad on both sides, and there's not a clear winning argument. As it is now, it's true. The setup now puts a certain kind of person in the legislature. They tend to be older or in the, mostly it's older, I would say. There's a lot of white men in there. That represents a certain part of the state, but certainly not all of the state. I tend to think that the age difference is a significant issue because there is a very different mindset among the older generation versus the younger generation. I know we hear that a lot, but if you look at the Senate budget hearing that we just had before Senate Finance, there was no shortage of people who came out against that divisive concept bill as the most, that was the most talked about issue at that hearing. And so, you know, are they hearing this information? Are they absorbing it? So where are they getting their information? Who is their constituency? So yes, you know, they're very accessible. You can call them and they're very, very accessible, which might not be true if they had staffs and we paid them. But it does put a certain kind of person in the State House for sure.
Speaking of longstanding debates, Josh, there's another longstanding issue included in the budget. What supporters call education freedom accounts, what opponents call school vouchers. People who want these have been unable to get them through year after year. What about this year? And why is this included in the budget, Josh?
Well, it's, I mean, there's fiscal implications, so it would be natural to tuck something like that into the budget.
Sure, that makes
sense.
You
know, this is an issue that, you know, Governor Sununu, in terms of if you wanted to say a straight line through his entire political career, he's always been quite supportive of sort of choice in education. And, you know, this is something that Republicans have increasingly become comfortable with. I mean, you can recall the struggles this bill has had in the past getting out of the House, in particular due to concerns over the fiscal implications and the uncertainties around that. You know, there are a lot of people in the House in particular who are very, very conservative, very distrustful of public schools and believe that, you know, freedom of choice in education will improve outcomes. And, you know, to the earlier emailer's question about, you know, paid legislators, I mean, one thing that is interesting is that, you know, this was alluded to yesterday in the Senate. At one point, Senator Morse made the illusion that, like, we have the selectmen in the Senate, I mean, people who also have served as selectmen. And, you know, one thing that I think has changed a little bit about the legislature, particularly this current legislature in the House, is the trajectory of sort of public service that lands somebody in the House. Traditionally, you know, people are recruited to run for the House who may be, you know, members of select boards, you know, zoning boards, library trustees, et cetera, people who are involved in local government. And, you know, I've talked to people who recruit for Republican candidates, and they say, you know, that path to being a lawmaker is less common these days. And I think you can see that reflected in some of the choices that are being made, that it is not people who necessarily are sitting in municipal meetings and, you know, hearing about issues in cities and towns who, you know, and to people who are on the sort of more libertarian side of things, they say that's good. We don't want people with you know, sort of high-bound notions of how government ought to operate necessarily. We need people to think more clearly. But I think you can see in some of the bills that are passing and some of the priorities in the budget, you know, a distrust of government that, you know, you didn't used to see in such a pronounced fashion in the House.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for your time. We'll talk to you again. Josh Rogers, it's good to talk to you. Thank you.
Nice to chat with you, Laura.
That's NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers, and Anne-Marie Timmons. It's been good to have you on the show today, too. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always nice to be with you.
That's Anne-Marie Timmons, senior reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin. Well, as the roundup continues, here's another story NHPR has reported on this week. The Biden administration's Solicitor General has recommended that the U.S. Supreme Court not take up a case concerning the tax status of more than 100,000 Granite Staters who commute to Massachusetts for work. Normally, those Granite Staters pay Bay State income taxes, but during the pandemic, many were working at home. New Hampshire officials argued they should therefore not be liable for Mass taxes during that time period. Yesterday, our congressional delegation weighed in, all of them. U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen said she was disappointed, that she had hoped the White House would urge the Supreme Court to reverse what she called an unfair and unconstitutional tax burden on Granite State workers. So we have more on that story and more on our website. Check it out, nhpr.org. Well, coming up after a very quick break, the latest on the recount in Windham, and then we'll hear about a new NHPR series on how Granite Staters are reconnecting as the pandemic eases. Tell us your stories when you call 800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. How are you reconnecting with the people and places and things that you love? Again, exchange at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and we'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, in for Peter Biello. Monday on our show, for Memorial Day, an NPR special called We've Never Been the Same, a war story. Then on Tuesday, it's our annual summer book show. Today, as we catch up on the week's news, we turn to the election recount in the southern tier town of Windham. Also, we'll hear about a brand new NHPR series called For the First Time Again, where Granite Staters share their stories of reconnecting with favorite people and pastimes, from book clubs to baseball games. Listeners, tell us what you're planning to do for the first time again, once you feel it's okay to do so. Give us a call, 800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Well, with us now on both of these stories is Casey McDermott, NHPR's investigative and data reporter. And welcome back, Casey, and thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So the Windham election audit wrapped up yesterday with auditors finding no fraud. Just remind our listeners, Casey, what was the focus of this audit?
Sure. So this traces back to a state rep race in Windham. And what happened was, Windham is historically a conservative town. Republicans swept all four legislative seats the night of the election. But there was a Democratic candidate who came within about 24 votes, according to the machine count. On election night at the polls. That Democratic candidate asked for a recount because she was within the margin to do so. And what happened was during that hand recount, the margin widened a lot. So what happened was the Democratic candidate lost nearly 100 votes and each of the Republican candidates gained nearly 300 votes during the recount. So that set off a lot of questions from a lot of people for valid reasons, because that's kind of a strange pattern. It's not unusual for candidates to gain votes during recounts. Part of that has to do with the fact that, humans read ballots differently than machines do sometimes, just depending on how they're marked up. But it was a weird pattern. So people, on both sides of the aisle wanted to investigate. The Democratic candidate, Christy St. Laurent, petitioned to the Ballot Law Commission to look into it, partially because they're role involves overseeing New Hampshire's ballot counting devices. So there was a thought that perhaps, it was part of their purview to ensure that those devices were counting things appropriately. The Ballot Law Commission said they didn't have the standing to do that. They asked the Attorney General's office to look into it. The Attorney General's office also said they didn't have the standing to do anything. So eventually, Republican State Senator Bob Guida was kind of frustrated with the lack of action on the part of other state officials, filed legislation to specifically authorize an audit of Windham's results. And that was the audit that took place over the last few weeks that we saw outside of Concord.
Wow. So you talked about the machines and the hand count. And let's play a little bit, Casey, from Mark Lindemann. He is one of the auditors, and he talked about the importance of just routine checks of the system.
Our viewpoint, I think I speak for all of us, is that no matter how new or old the system is, you need to check its work. And that's why routine post-election audits are so important. In some ways, focusing on the machines is not the most important thing. I mean, or focusing on the machines in isolation. Okay, so we can scrutinize machines from here until doomsday, but what we actually want to know is, did the machines get the right result?
So what is the significance of this, Casey, in the larger picture, not just for Windham, but New Hampshire's elections overall?
Yeah, so I think that remains to be seen. I just following up on that clip that you just played, I do think that it's important to point out that New Hampshire is actually in the minority of states that does not routinely audit its election results, just as a matter of policy. There are lots of different ways to audit. And an audit, I think it's worth mentioning, is different from a recount. So a recount is something that, usually a candidate has to specifically request. There's usually like kind of a margin of victory or loss that a race has to fall into in order to qualify for a recount. Audits, on the other hand, are done, I think without regard to the margin of victory. They can look at kind of a random sampling of races. Some of them are statewide. There are different ways to handle it. But basically, like Mark Lindemann was saying, the goal of audits is just to kind of check that the system worked appropriately. So I think one of the things on a lot of people's minds right now is, how will this inform New Hampshire's posture toward routinely auditing its election results? There was a test that was done last winter to evaluate different systems that could be used to help New Hampshire audit its election results. State officials are still kind of studying how that might work. The audit team that was convened, there were a trio of experts, Mark Lindemann, Harry Hursty, who is a well-known kind of quote-unquote ethical hacker and election security expert, was another member of the audit team, and then Philip Stark, who is a professor of statistics at UC Berkeley, who also has been involved in kind of pioneering what are called risk-limiting audits. That group of auditors that were involved in the Wyndham race are going to spend, you know, the next 45 days or so. That's the time frame that they have, kind of digesting the results of what they saw over the last few weeks, and then also coming up with some recommendations for New Hampshire about, you know, how to improve vote counting processes based on what they found in the audit. And just on that note, in terms of the findings, I think it's important to stress, you know, you indicated that there was no fraud found, there was no, you know, malicious tampering or anything like that. What this came down to was something kind of rather mundane. It had to do with the folds and the way that absentee ballots were folded. The fold line on some of the ballots ran through the bubble for that Democratic candidate who appeared to have more votes on election night than she did during the recount. So the machine picked up that fold as a vote for her. And then that also had some ripple effects that caused the Republican candidates to not receive as many votes, even though they still won the race. So there's it's a little in the weeds, but it's amazing.
Right.
You know, kind of, you know, different kind of factors that could go into ensuring that races are counted accurately. And that's a lot of people who've been watching the audit have been saying that, you know, that underscores the importance of just, like, you know, taking the time to check these things and to, you know, check the machines, make sure they're working, check
sure.
all of the different moving parts that go into an election.
Well, that's interesting. You have to fold the thing when you put it in the envelope, but then it ends up causing some confusion on the counting end. That's really interesting, Casey. I want to close out by asking you about something fun, and that is
yes.
NHPR's new listener-driven series called For the First Time Again. What's the goal, Casey?
So the goal here is that obviously we don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. We know that, you know, the pandemic has had, you know, wide-ranging implications for a lot of people, and in many ways it's still ongoing. That being said, we know that there are a lot of people that are kind of navigating a quote unquote new normal. And that's kind of a cliche phrase, but just getting back to doing things, you know, now that it's safer, now that they may be vaccinated or their loved ones or neighbors or friends may be vaccinated. So we wanted to try to kind of capture, you know, what is this like for people? And we have a kind of ongoing call out for people to share with us. You know, what are you doing for the first time again? So far, we've heard from, for example, you know, when schools were returning to full-time in-person learning, we heard from a teacher and a student about, you know, what their experiences were like there, respectively. We also heard from the announcer for the Fisher Cats about what it was like to get back to, you know, baseball after a season away. We're also, you know, talking to other people just about the kind of more, you know, less kind of, you know, the things that don't maybe come with as much fanfare, but they're still important. So if, for example, you know, seeing a grandchild or reuniting with friends that you had a weekly kind of walk or brunch routine with, we're looking for, you know, kind of milestones that people are going through, proms, weddings, things of that nature, but also stuff, you know, that are as kind of, you know, informal, but important as, you know, being able to hug someone you love again.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And I remember I've heard from a lot of grandparents who are just in pain over the past year, not being able to see their grandkids and vice versa. So those are great stories to hear. So if people are listening, Casey, and thinking, I want to share my story about, you know, for the first time again, how can they share their stories with NHPR?
Sure. So there are a few ways to do that. They can send us an email at voices@nhpr.org. You know, they can just tell us what they're doing, what they're planning to do. Ideally, it would be great, you know, if they could let us know ahead of time so that maybe we could coordinate a way to, like, kind of capture the scene as it's happening or work with them to maybe get videos or photos or things like that so that they can share that scene with the rest of our audience. People are also welcome to call NHPR's audience hotline. The number, I will give it slowly and we'll repeat it twice, is 603-513-7790. Again, that's 603 513-7790. And people can leave us a message there just, you know, telling us about what they're planning to do and why they would like to share that with us.
Well, it's great to close the roundup up today, Casey, with something positive and fun and heartwarming and all that. And we will put that information on our website as well about how folks can share their stories for the first time again. Casey, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Laura.
That's Casey McDermott, NHPR's investigative and data reporter. Remember, you can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. Once again, nhpr.org. Today's show was produced by our senior producer, Christina Phillips. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.